Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Who goes on the holiday tree is a recurring theme for me. I've been having fun with it for years. But the fun really began shortly after I'd separated from my second wife, and my daughter was spending weekends with me, and after a year of being essentially homeless, that is to say, sleeping wherever friends would let me sleep, I rented a room in a house in Fairhaven, New Jersey, from one of my fellow members of the Unitarian Universalist congregation in Lincroft, of which I was a member while doing community ministry for quite a few years. And Al, you know, was someone who came from a Jewish background, had spent part of his life living in Africa, in Arab Africa, of all places, and was now settled in semi-retirement in Fairhaven, and had a room he liked to rent out in a second house on the same property. So I could afford the room, not the second house. But I asked Al if he would mind if I put up a Christmas tree for when my daughter visited around Christmas time. He said, "Oh, that would be great fun. I've never had a Christmas tree." Of course not. He was Jewish. He'd never had a Christmas tree. So I went out and we agreed on where I'd put it up, and I went out and I bought some sets of lights and some cheap ornaments, and then I got a tree that stood about maybe so high. And he agreed, agreed on where I'd set up in the living room. I set it up, my daughter's over there. She decorated it with me, and then we went off and did other things and came back. And Al, for whom the description Unitarian Buddhaversalist fit, a term I first heard close to 40 years ago, had hung a Buddha statue in the tree. And that's what got me thinking about, as Unitarian Universalist, particularly on the Universalist side, and inclusivity, well, why not a Buddha on the Christmas tree? So, excuse me for a moment while I put a Buddha on the tree. So we now have a Buddha on the holiday tree. Well, I fail to see any representations of anything related to Jesus on this particular tree. We'll let that go. Because everyone knows that the Christmas tree has many possible origins. You know, the mystery tree from medieval mystery plays. In some places, these plays would be done on Christmas Eve, and there'd be a tree in the middle of representing the tree in the Garden of Eden. And the actors would pick apples off of them, and then these became decorations where fruit would be hung on the trees. Often apples. It's interesting how, you know, they would celebrate what was supposedly the fruit that led to the downfall. Religious and cultural customs don't always make a whole lot of sense to us today. Then there are other stories that maybe was adapted from old Germanic customs having to do with trees and how central trees were to northern European cultures. Some people don't think that counts because already in the Mediterranean, early in the Christian era, Christians had adopted a Roman custom of building triangular shells and putting candles on them as Saturnalia decorations. And then some of the early Christians adopted that, and those sort of look like a tree because of their shape. The actual origin of Christmas trees is confused, but interesting. You have that mystery play tree of life thing. You also had a history in pre-Christian times in Northern Europe of putting green boughs on the doors of houses to ward off evil spirits, the origins of the Christmas wreaths. And I suspect my father, being Swedish and having no great love for the state church of Sweden in which he grew up, was probably drawing on deep pagan roots in making that wreath every year. He also truly loved the woods and the trees and that land we lived on in Connecticut, which looked a lot like southwestern Sweden where he was from. But actual Christmas trees, there are records of those going back to the 1400s. It was now Estonia and Lithuania. There was a custom of setting up, of taking the tree from the mystery plays, the Christmas plays, and carrying them out to the town square with candles on them, dancing around them with the young men and the young ladies of the village getting to meet each other, and then burning the tree in the town square. There are definite records of Christmas trees being kept up as decorations from the 16th century in that part of Europe, and well established in Germany by within a century after that. And even with Germans in Canada setting up Christmas trees in the 1700s. Sorry, we can't claim that the Unitarian minister, Charles Follen, who was German, was the first one to bring it to North America. But he did popularize it amongst the Yankee elites of New England. And there had actually been some German prisoners during the Revolutionary War who set up a tree in a prison camp where they were held in Connecticut during the Revolutionary War. Lots of great stories about how we got the Christmas tree. And there are lots of great stories about how immigrants from other cultures have related to Christmas trees. I may have mentioned my Aunt Kitty and Uncle Mikey, who were really my great Aunt Kitty and great Uncle Mikey. Uncle Mikey, in my whole extended Italian-Sicilian family in the Bronx, was the only devout Catholic. He went to Mass every day. He was an apartment building super in the Bronx. And he went to Mass every day. Aunt Kitty was Jewish. Can you imagine a Catholic-Jewish wedding in the Bronx in the 1930s? I mean, that was pretty far out then. And so, you know, when we'd visit them and their three daughters, my cousins, in their basement apartment in the Bronx where the sun never shone, they had what they referred to as a Hanukkah bush. And they had drawings that represented both Christmas and Hanukkah. And Rabbi Joel Plout has written a whole book on the 12 days of Hanukkah. And Christmas trees, and Jewish Christmas trees, and Christian Jewish customs. And most of the great pop music songs of the American Songbook that have to do with Christmas were written and or performed by Jews. Mel Torme, you know. He wrote, you know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, and also made one of the best recordings of Good King Wenceslas I've ever heard. I mean, that's the standard for that song, his recording.
White Christmas.
Yeah, White Christmas. I mean, many of them were written and recorded. So, you know, we've mixed these cultures up and made pastiches of them. And then we have what we call neutral holiday trees. I think that's what we have here until the Buddha went on it. But it's okay. There are other trees. I read you that little bit from Voluspa about Yggdrasil, the world tree, the world tree motif in Norse mythology. I mentioned that to my sister Maria the other day. Oh, I forgot about Yggdrasil. I used to read those stories to Sebi when he was a kid. Sebi's now a junior in college. But Yggdrasil is an evergreen ash tree. Now, an ash tree is a hardwood tree. It does drop its leaves ordinarily. But Yggdrasil, the world tree in Norse mythology, stayed green year-round, and it was the center of the world. Just as in many other cultures, going back to, at least to the ancient Mideast and in other continents and other cultures, trees have represented the center of the world. What Mircea Eliade called the axis mundi, the axis of the earth. And houses would be built to resemble trees. And there'd be a center post resembling a tree, pointing to the axis of the earth. And so Yggdrasil in the Norse mythology represented that. And there were springs at the base, and deer that drank from the springs and ate of the tree, but never were able to eat enough to hurt the tree. And the Norns were what we would call witches, but that's not really quite the right. They were more like forest spirits who lived at the base of the tree. And then there's a whole story about the creation of the world and the last battle at Ragnarok and how the leaves of the tree will be singed, but it will still put forth new greenery. Yeah, that's some of the symbolism that's tied up in our holiday tree. And some of the things that echo when people look at it, no matter what the particular decorations are, depending on what culture they're from. But there are other important trees. And another one that comes up at this time of year is the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree under which Buddha was enlightened. December 8th is Bodhi Day in Japan. A holiday where trees are decorated with lamps in three colors to represent enlightenment, the Dharma, and Sangha. And it is a celebration of the teachings of Buddha and of the Enlightenment. Now, what's a Bodhi tree? Has anyone ever seen a Bodhi tree? I bet you have, some of you. Also known as a bow or banyan tree. Yeah, because I remember reading how Shakyamuni or Gautama, depending on which version, sat under the tree for 7 weeks, fasting, until he was enlightened. And I think, how does he sit under a tree for 7 weeks? You know, I mean, we had this big hemlock tree, and there's lots of room under it, but 7 weeks under that tree? Well, as you know, a bow or banyan tree casts out secondary trunks that drop down as runners from the branches. And I finally got this, came to understand it in Lahaina, in Maui, which is, as you know, a New England whaling shipping village in Hawaii. That was the stopping point for the whaling ships crossing the Pacific, and the houses all look like they're on the coast of Massachusetts. But on the town square, there's a banyan tree that covers over a third of an acre, one tree. And also, at least when I was there about 25 years ago, the largest statue of Buddha outside of Asia. So many new Buddhist temples have been around the world since then. I'm not sure it still is, but at that time it was. And there was a third of an acre. Sure, you could stay under there for weeks. I'm still working on the fasting for 7 weeks. That one I don't get. But shelter, what a shelter that is. And there are banyan trees in this country. There's one on the grounds of the Museum of Fine Arts in St. Petersburg, a magnificent specimen. And another one in the parking lot of the St. Petersburg Senior Center, which is sort of protected. But the curb going up to the main trunk doesn't help it. But that's kind of a magical tree. And there are stories about how cuttings from that tree have been planted elsewhere for reverence and meditation in the Indian subcontinent. And even that one of them was planted with the historical Buddha's own permission to help his followers meditate. Trees as the axis of the world, but also a place of shelter. There's a kind of a ever-evolving Christmas review called Mi Casa Tu Casa that's done by a bunch of art musicians and actors from the Jersey City area. And it's in three languages, English, Spanish, and Spanglish. And the first time I saw this review, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, this girl who'd come to New York or New Jersey or one of the dense cities from Puerto Rico and is living with her mother and father and brother and sister in a one-bedroom apartment. And so the children are sleeping in the living room, which she never liked very much, but then there would be Christmas, and they'd put up a Christmas tree. And instead of sleeping in the regular fold-out sofa, she would get to sleep under the tree, and she felt so happy and safe there, with the tree as a very different kind of shelter than the windows of their apartment and the doors. A shelter that didn't just protect them from the storm, but held them in a warm way and helped them feel even more loved than they knew they were by their parents. And we certainly do need that kind of shelter these days, where we can feel safe and warm and loved. I told you I've done several services with this theme. On December 16th, 2012, it was 2 days after the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, in the school. And I was at a church about 40 miles from Newtown. There was no way not to incorporate that into that Sunday. And that was the Sunday we had a mitten tree in that congregation where children came up and brought gifts to go to poor families. And as they were bringing the gifts up and pinning them on the tree, the flaming chalice started melting down. And it looked like we might have our own disaster there. Yeah, it was a big pewter chalice filled with stones with a sterno can of alcohol and salt in it, which is where the flame came from. The sterno can melted. The burning alcohol started going down through the stones and coming out through the side of the chalice. One of the members of the congregation saw this happening and went up and stood between the now melting down chalice and the Christmas tree. And the children are gone. And the pianist is playing, "Oh, fir tree," which is what it translates into. "Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree." People were singing, "Oh, mitten tree, oh, mitten tree." And people were waving at the guy standing next to it. And he's just nodding. The kids get finished. He turns around. He grabs the chalice, which is now pouring flames down the side, walks out to the porch of the building, and puts it out there. And people said, "Wow, that was really brave." He said, "Brave, this is what I do for a living. I'm a firefighter." So if, you know, a good person to have in your congregation if your flaming chalice melts down. He'd also had an undergraduate degree in theater, so he really knew how to make it work. But we do need, you know, but we needed not to have a problem that Sunday because there was already so much hurt in the room. After children had left, we did talk about that as part of the service, the shootings, and how to talk with children about that. But while the children were there, we needed not to have our own catastrophe. And good David Morkel helped us not to have our own catastrophe there. And then a year later, I did a service on this theme in Clearwater, Florida. What was it? 3 days after the death of Nelson Mandela. And so part of that service was devoted to the memory of Mandela, including a poem written by his daughter about how a tree was cut down in the forest today, which she had written the day her father died. And so, yes, we had our Christmas celebration and our tree, but also another recognition of loss. And now we have what's becoming almost a daily occurrence in this country of mass killings. One statistic says there's a killing with at least 4 victims almost every day in the United States. And there is a lot of pain and hurt in the world. And it is important that there will be letters at the social justice table today about solidarity with the people of Planned Parenthood of Colorado Springs. And the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Colorado Springs was probably the first person in public to call it an act of terrorism and was roundly criticized for doing so as they were holding a memorial service in that church. But yet we live with that fear every day, and how do we keep our children safe? And how do we keep ourselves safe? And how do we keep warmth and love alive? Well, there's one thing that these sorts of troubles seem to be coming closer and closer to home, and closer to the holiday season, it seems. But I'm not sure that's true in particular. Maybe it's just we're more heightened in our awareness. But I remember something I heard Bill Quigley, who's a lawyer from New Orleans, whose house was wiped out during the hurricanes in 2006, 2005, at a meeting in New Orleans about 15 months after Katrina and Rita hit. He said, there is a disaster in every community in this country. Our challenge is to walk softly and to be in solidarity. And that indeed is part of the challenge, and for me, much of the part of the message of the various holidays that we celebrate this time of year. Walking softly and being in solidarity. You may have seen the quote in The Nation last week. Wouldn't it be great if we had a seasonally appropriate story about refugees being turned away? Oh, we do. It's called the gospel narratives of Jesus' birth. Not technically refugees, but homeless people. People in need of a welcome who get turned away. And how do we respond to these fears? Do we turn more people away, or do we find ways of being loving and welcoming and sharing the shelter we do have, even as we strive to be sure our children and those we love and those around us have the shelter and the care that they need? Tree is shelter, and tree is celebration. This is a tree of celebration here. Not your typical Christmas tree. I don't see angels, but I see ornaments. I see lights. Is there an angel? Where's the angel hidden? Oh, up on top. Gosh, you know, I don't. Boy, I'm relieved. I was looking at all these ribbons and these flowers and these butterflies saying, these are great life symbols, but where's the Christmas stuff? There it is. And I think, well, maybe, you know, maybe nice to have a little Bodhi tree, too, with lights and beads. And there are three ornaments representing the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Well, you got Buddha up there. And maybe the idea of the Buddha in the tree is not such an idea that's so odd as I first thought it was when Al did that. I mean, it sort of seemed immediately right, but it still is intellectually a little odd, but as you know, some years ago, a Christian scholar named Marcus Borg lined up sayings of the Buddha and sayings of Jesus and showed an incredible number of similarities. And I have a book I got more recently, Jesus, Buddha, Hindu texts, and Lao Tzu, and many parallels. Not that they're all the same, but they're parallels. And so maybe we need to celebrate, as well as we are be concerned of people who need shelter, of danger, of people who are hurt and harmed. We need to be welcoming and loving, but also to affirm life and to keep nurturing life in ourselves and around us. You know, like that hymn of reflection, being whole, being healthy. And along that vein, I started thinking a little further. Some years ago, during my first interim ministry, I was at the Newark Museum, and there was this lovely print of a depiction of the Hindu deity Ganesha. The one with the elephant's tusk, multiple hands, or the elephant's head, the human body, multiple hands. And I did some reading on that. And I thought, and Ganesha, you know, is a manifestation of deity. And in Hinduism, there are many manifestations of deity. And it actually, I've actually heard Hindus say, well, Jesus was also an avatar of the one deity, as well as the particular gods and goddesses from their own practices. But then I read on, Ganesha, success, yeah, this, and then remover of obstacles. And I thought, this must be the patron saint of interim ministry. The remover of obstacles. So I bought that print, and I had my office. But then I thought, a year ago, I wonder, and I looked, and I got a Ganesha ornament for the tree. Ken Patton, no, he believed that there were insights to be found in all religions, even as he presented himself a very pared-down kind of humanism. And he collected all sorts of religious symbols and artwork to demonstrate that. And so in a time when there was stress and danger and war and terrorism and poverty, and like Bill Quigley said, a disaster in every community in this country every day, young black men shot in the back by police officers, terrorists invading healthcare centers. You know, the poverty that is endemic in parts of our country. The infrastructure that is falling apart, producing dangers for people just going about their own legal, normal business. We need to affirm life, celebrate life, and celebrate all the sources of life, the biological sources, the spiritual sources, the philosophical sources, the things that hold us up and nurture us and keep us thinking and alive and active even when we're struggling with deep challenges and seemingly insurmountable challenges. So however you celebrate, and whatever you call your decorative tree, Hanukkah bush, Christmas tree, holiday tree, whatever. Let's make it a place of shelter for your spirit and celebration for the love that we would bring to this world. So may it be. Amen.